Okay, good morning everybody, and welcome to our continuation on the discussion of the false ego, our constant companion and troublemaker. Yes, we are set up with a translation. Whoever needs translation has the little thing there. Good. Okay, so do we have anybody who was not here yesterday? Okay, some of you. Yeah, can't really repeat everything, but just in a nutshell, so yesterday we established how the false ego is affecting us, that we are trying to imagine to be something which we are not. We are playing certain roles in life. You know, each lifetime we are playing different roles. One life we are a man, one life a woman's body, then father, mother, husband, wife, teacher, whatever it may be. They are all roles. They are caps or hats we are wearing. But it's not that I am the hat. No. And we are identifying with these roles because they give us some subtle or gross sense enjoyment, some gratification for the false ego. We get some little recognition, some little satisfaction from this. And that's why we get attached to it, and that's why we identify with it. So, and we were going through all different examples, and we were saying, you know, Bhagavad Gita 18:58, Krishna is giving us two choices. Either we act in consciousness of Him, meaning being humble servant, then Krishna helps us to overcome all obstacles in life. Or if we don't want to act in that kind of consciousness, but we are motivated by false ego, because it's a very powerful motivating force, the ego, so then we cannot hear Krishna and we will be lost. Sooner or later we always get ourselves into trouble and the title of the seminar is called The False Ego, Our Constant Companion and Troublemaker. And we were also establishing that the bigger our false ego is, the less we can perceive it. And I was telling this humor story of one Madhuji who has this huge ego and gets herself always into a conflict. And I was saying to her, yes, this false ego always gets us into trouble. I simply wanted to make a careful hint. And she was laughing and saying, false ego, come on, what's that? I don't have that. So that's really how the ego blocks our ears, blocks our intelligence. We cannot hear, we cannot understand. It actually requires some little purification to become more sensitive towards subtleties. And the ego is so subtle. Oh my God. Actually, I have to admit, to put together this seminar and to give it again and again immensely helps me to recognize where my ego is getting in my way and where my ego is pushing me to say things which I shouldn't better say and to do things which I better shouldn't do. And so it has helped me immensely. I think in the first 10 or 15 years, I was not even aware of this false ego. So I'm just trying to save a bit of your time here by bringing this attention and awareness to this topic of false ego. And we were also saying that one can easily miss the whole target of Krishna consciousness. Instead of dissolving and subduing our ego, we can blow it up, we can feed it, we can massage each other's egos. Oh, you know, Krishna consciousness offers so much opportunity for this. And it's going on. It's going on massively, actually. Yes. And then, you know, we will be here lifetime after lifetime, even though we might be trying to chant the Maha Mantra and. But without the false ego being really transformed in the true ego of I am a humble servant, you know, we actually cannot get out of here. That's the whole thing. So we will continue in the discussion. But I want to add one little more example to our last discussion on 1858, where Krishna says, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. So I want to go one more time back to these two motivating forces. And the example came up to my mind recently when I was in Mayapur and I was giving this course. And one devotee was saying to me, but you know, Mataji, don't we need goals? I mean, you know, we need goals and we should strive for them. And he was saying to me, well, didn't you have the goal of becoming a preacher and traveling worldwide, and you were really endeavoring for that and writing books and all that? And I realized, no. You know, a devotee and a non-devotee, they have very different approaches to success. Very different. Yes. And when I was given that question, it really clicked on me, you know, because every time, actually, even as a speaker, the topic opens up more and you get actually new realizations. You learn something new. And when this question was put to me, you know, I realized, no, a non-devotee, a materialist, he endeavors with this ego motivation, with this ego drive. I want to become this. And okay, let me get the books and let me study and I want to become this and this and this, whatever it may be. But a devotee, that's the ego drive, the ego motivation. You know, we are identifying with a certain role and with a certain cap and we want to achieve that. But a devotee has a whole different approach. A devotee simply cultivates this intense desire to serve. That's a devotee's path to success. Just cultivating that mood, Krishna, I want to serve. All I want to do is serve you and your devotees. That's the Krishna conscious, non-ego drive path of success. And it is interesting, if we actually really cultivate that mood of serving, pleasing the devotees, pleasing Srila Prabhupada, Paramatma is there in the heart and witnesses that. And Paramatma opens all the opportunities. Paramatma makes the right arrangement at the right time. He uses us as an instrument. That was definitely my path. I never ever imagined as a young devotee that I would be in white with a shaved head, traveling the world, preaching, giving seminars, having an institute for the spiritual culture. No. I was not, you know, imagining this at all. I just tried to cultivate a selfless service mode, just being ready to do whatever is required, serving the devotees. And then Krishna opens all the right opportunities. Yes. So it's a very different approach. Very different. You know? You get my point? Yes. This is important to understand because these days I often come across this. You know, that young devotees not even initiated. You know, they have this whole ego ambitiousness. Oh, and they ask me sometimes, oh, can you send me your materials of this course? Then I also want to give it. Hey, you know, no, that's not the process. We actually need some little empowerment by the Lord, actually. You know, we can't think that, oh, if I just do all these courses and I get the materials, then I can become a preacher. No, no. That's the ego way of trying to become successful. But like that, we don't get anywhere. No, no. First of all, you know, that there is purpose in the Bhagavatam where Prabhupada expresses how important tapasya is. You know, austerities. You know, and he says, even Lord Brahma performed so many tapasyas, the pratetas, so many tapasyas. So to perform tapasya, that purifies the heart from the desire to enjoy. Because tapasya means you have to give up your comfort, your convenience, your enjoyment to please others for the pleasure of somebody else. So that's tapasya. So especially in the beginning, we have to go through this school of tapasya. And then if Krishna sees, oh, this person is willing to sacrifice so much for my pleasure, then Krishna, you know, gives some little mercy, some little empowerment. Krishna opens all kinds of opportunities. Yes, that's the way. So we can't just think, you know, if we become ambitious and have our goals there. And of course, we should have goals, but actually they should always be given by seniors. We should be doing things on the order of seniors, of guru, of senior devotees. You know, and if I may use my humble example, you know, I was starting to write on the order of Shivam Swami, actually. He was telling me again and again, he was saying to me, so now you've got your Institute of Spiritual Culture, where are your books? You know, yeah, he was saying to this to me again and again, you know. And then I was saying to him, yeah, okay, but while I have good health, I want to travel and preach and give these courses. And when my health declines, then I will sit down and write. And sure enough, 2 years ago, maybe you remember I shared it last year, you know, I came down again once more time with cancer. I had to do chemotherapy. And then immediately I realized, wow, now is my chance to sit down and write. And that's when I put that first book, that red book together. It was while I was doing chemo. Without this chemotherapy, there would be no books. So it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. No, seriously. Because I would have never stopped traveling and sat down. I mean, to write, at least for me, I have to sit down and hide and just get up, chant my rounds and write all day, 5-6 hours a day. Otherwise, I can't think myself into the whole topic. I can't do that while I'm traveling. Impossible for me. So I would have not stopped traveling if I hadn't been forced to by my health. So now I have a taste for writing, and I realize this is enhancing my humble preaching effort so much. So now I'm not waiting for the next chemotherapy. I do it voluntarily. Yeah, so last year I was hiding 2 months in Ukraine. And, you know, I wrote the second book, and this will be part of my regular sadhana now in the summer months when people are busy with Rath Yatra and festivals and I'm hiding and writing. But it came on the order, you know. And after Shivam Swami instructed me, I asked my Guru Maharaj Nanda Swami, what do you think, you know, Shivam Swami is telling me to write? And he said to me, yes, well, you know, if you have the feeling, you have some message for people, you better write. You know, yes. So it has to come on the order. You know, otherwise, very easily becomes some ego thing. Oh, I'm publishing my books. And, you know, sometimes I see this also, very young devotees, hardly even initiated. Oh, I'm writing my books. You know, that there has to be a certain empowerment and a certain authorization by seniors. The order has to come. And even Prabhupada himself, he shares this, that he had no idea how he would fulfill this mission of bringing Krishna consciousness to the West. No idea, no real plan. His two secrets of success were that once... One secret was that that he had this mood of just being willing to sacrifice his very life to fulfill the orders of his guru. You know, this service mood. Okay, my guru tells me this is what I should do. How on earth will I do this? Please, you know, empower me, show me, you know, I don't know. Yes. So being willing to sacrifice one's life. And the second secret of success of Prabhupada was to feel helplessly dependent on the mercy of his Guru Maharaj, of the previous acharyas. This mood of helpless dependence. These are the two secrets how we, you know, can attract the merciful glance of the Lord and Srila Prabhupada upon us, that we feel helplessly dependent on mercy and guidance, and that we are willing to give our very life. These are the two secrets, you know, and not that ego ambition, oh yes. You know, Prabhupada didn't say, yes, hey, I'm Shaktivesha Avatar, so I will show the world, you know, that I can spread Krishna consciousness or something. No. Wrong motivation. All right? Do we have any quick question on this? Because I think this example makes it very clear, you know, the two motivating forces. Right? One motivating force is all I want to do is serve, and the other motivating force is I want to become like this, the ambitious, you know, ambitiousness of wanting to become something. Yeah? Right? Yes, Baba. Microphone, we have some microphones so our internet hearers can also hear the question.
You were saying about the motivation.
Yes.
Sometimes of devotees, they have their visions of success. And what the right motivation...
They have what?
Their vision of what the preaching success they want and what this should be. And but you were explaining that our motivation should be just wanting eagerly to serve, and
yes,
and then the success, so-called success, comes.
Yes.
But in that case, we are still measuring success with this material vision, with becoming, with publishing, with becoming something,
yes,
important inside,
yes,
institution. So I wanted to ask, we should have some different measure of success. What is...
Very true.
Yeah, you were speaking about the right motivation. Now, if you can speak about the right measure of success, when,
yes,
I know I'm successful.
Yes.
Thank you.
Actually, that connects with the topic of this evening. There we will discuss some 2, 4, 6 steps of how to actually do this internal work of dissolving the false ego. And I'm pointing out there that this is actually real success, and then we achieve the real purification, you know, and we actually make advancement when we do this internal work. Very true. You know, we can say there's external success and there's internal success. And of course, to some extent, the external success also indicates something, you know, because even Prabhupada was saying that the success of a program is measured in how many books are distributed. Because when people take a book home after a program, then they're getting something. You know, but if people just attend some lecture, and even if there's thousands of people there, like in India, Bangladesh, we have these big pandal programs, and, you know, with thousands of people coming, this is almost useless unless they take a book home. You know, what will they remember of this pandal program? They attend so many pandal programs of all kinds of Babaji's and Sai Baba and this and that. You know, so what will they remember? Nothing. You know, so to some extent, you know, we can measure the success, because also Krishna, if we actually have that desire to serve, then Krishna, as we were just establishing, Krishna opens certain avenues, Krishna arranges, Krishna gives. Krishna gives Lakshmi, so many amazing things happen. You know? So, all of a sudden, temples opening, this, that, you know, if it is done on that motivation of simply wanting to serve and we get that empowerment of the Lord and Srila Prabhupada, you know, then even the external success manifests. But on the other hand, even though there may not be some external success, that also sometimes happens, that Krishna puts the handbrake on, you know. And, yeah, so then there might be also so much internal success there, you know. And also I once heard a nice explanation in a class that if we are in a situation where we wish we could do more and we have all kinds of ideas what we could actually do, how we can contribute to the Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement, but if for some reason it's just not happening, it means that Krishna thinks or can see that we are not ready to handle the success. In other words, that we are not humble enough, that if we would be successful, we become more proud and puffed up. You know? And that's why sometimes Krishna doesn't allow. Krishna first, you know, puts us through a bit more intense purification and ego bashing and whatever may be happening. And then, when we are ready to handle the success, then Krishna allows, you know? So, but in any case, and the other scenario can also be that externally it might look also fantastic and successful because maybe it is all developing on some ego drive, but then sooner or later it will collapse. It will all fall to pieces. I've seen that happening many times, you know. I know some temples even which developed like that, with somebody being really ambitious, you know, collecting like mad, putting some whole huge structure there, and it's all fantastic at the opening, and then 3 years later, it's a completely dead place, and nothing is happening, and there's, you know, 10, 15 devotees there, and the whole big temple is empty, you know, and it's just some external over-endeavor, you know. So there's all kinds of scenarios there in regards to external success and internal success, you know. But good to understand that this both is there. And once again, that's why it is so important to have mentorship, that we have a mentor. We have a person who guides us. You know, there is even... We will talk about that a little later, but let me mention it now, just so I don't forget. Even becoming a fanatic is a question of false ego. And there is a nice definition of what it means to become fanatic. If our enthusiasm is not guided by a higher intelligence than our own, we easily become fanatic. I'll say it again. If our enthusiasm is not guided by a higher intelligence than our own intelligence, we easily become fanatic. Why? Because our enthusiasm has a good mixture of mode of passion and ego drive. You know, while we are not pure devotees, our enthusiasm is not pure. Right? Yes, it is mixed with false ego, with mode of passion. So, and then very easily, the ego... The ego and passion affects our intelligence. And then... Our intelligence is also clouded by ego. And then again, we cannot hear, we cannot understand, we think we are on the right track, and yes, that's the way to go. You know, but it will not lead anywhere, you know. Or we become fanatic. You know, any good thing, this is the way how the ego can get its foot in the door anywhere. You know, so any valuable idea and important aspect of Krishna consciousness can be contaminated and spoiled and ruined by the false ego. Let's say book distribution. So important. But we can, if we have this ego drive there and we become fanatic, then our book distribution is the only way to please Prabhupada. And if you're not on the street for 8 hours a day and distribute books, you're not a devotee. And book distribution is so important. And because I recognize it, I'm the only one who recognizes the importance. That's why I am so important, because book distribution is so important. Right? And then we become fanatic. And that spoils and poisons that highly important aspect of book distribution. Huh? I'm sure we have all come across such a phenomena, right? Or Harinam Sankirtan. You know, the Yuga Dharma. Oh, Harinam, it's the way. 8 hours Harinam. Otherwise, we are not a devotee. We are not following Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement. Harinam is so important, and because I'm the only one who recognizes its importance, that's why I'm so important. And again, you know, this important aspect of Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan mission through our false ego is completely contaminated and ruined, you know. So that's why our enthusiasm has to be guided by a higher intelligence than our own to protect us from this fanaticism. Huh? Yes. Anyway, I wasn't planning to discuss this now, but it doesn't really matter. Sooner or later it will come, so now we're already discussing it here. We have some question about this. Microphone.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for mentioning this about our higher intelligence having to guide us, even if we have certain instructions. I remember this case when devotees were told to go out on the street and serve people. And
serve people?
Yes.
What? Distributing books? Harinam?
This was the instruction. This was like general instruction. Go out and serve people and preach about Krishna consciousness. So two devotees go out on the street, have these instructions, and they come back totally torn. Their clothes are torn. They are beaten up. So temple president asks, so what happened? It's like, yeah, we went out and we tried to help people and serve people. So we tried to help this old lady cross the street, and said, yes, so what's the problem? And they say, she didn't want to cross the street. So so
anyway, yeah, so that's why
the importance of higher intelligence.
Yeah, so that's why we need some guidance.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, any other points just about that? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. There's a question actually on Facebook because we are live there
streaming. Okay.
It's called like this. Is this success measured in realization of your relationship with Krishna?
Well, that's the ultimate success. But we need a good portion of purification to get there. You know? Yes. Actually, we will talk about that a little bit on the last session on Monday evening. So our Facebook audience has to attend all the sessions, and then you will find the answer. I don't want to get into that now. Yes, but that's the ultimate success, of course. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
It's me again, but if nobody else wants. About being guided with higher intelligence, I personally have big problem with seeing in every authority big anarthas. So how to deal with that? I see temple president, I see plenty of anarthas, I see senior devotees seeing only anarthas. How to deal with this then,
Krishna? Different topic. Sheltering relationships, there you will find the answer to all these different topics. There you find the answer, who is, what qualities does a person has to have in order to be able to give shelter to others?
No, but it's my problem.
Yeah, but, you know, we also have to be qualified. We have to know what qualities to look for, you know, because if you look for gold, you have to know what gold looks like. What qualities does it have? So if we are aspiring to develop sheltering and trusting relationships, we have to know what kind of qualifications has to be there. And there's also a whole chapter about envy, how envy blocks us the most from accepting shelter and from giving shelter, how envy manifests towards seniors, equals, juniors. You find it all in there. Please get a copy. Okay, let us use the last 17 minutes for what we actually wanted to talk about. But no harm, no loss. We've got time. We've got time. And this topic of fanaticism would have come up later anyway, but it fitted in well today, so that's why we took it up today. So I assume you all have the second lesson there in front of you, right? The materials. So, because our false ego is so dear to us, so near and dear to us, we always like to protect and defend it because it is so dear to us. So as we may know, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, the four animal propensities which we are meant to keep to a bare minimum, right? We are meant to reduce them as much as possible. And interestingly, they develop from gross to subtle. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Of course, defending, there is also a gross aspect to it and a subtle aspect. So when we talk about reducing the animal propensities, we do talk about the necessity of reducing eating, reducing sleeping, and reducing mating. But we hardly ever talk about the necessity of reducing defending. Right? Isn't it? I never really hear much about this. And if we hear about it, we might think of the gross form of defense. You know, physical, fighting back, defending yourself or something. But what is much more important is the subtle form of defense, the verbal defense. Yes, yes. And that we do all the time, every day. Actually, every day Krishna is putting us in some challenging, some slightly provocative situations, provocative to our ego. And what do? We always jump at it and do the wrong thing. We defend. Yes. So the subtle form of defense is that we answer back. We want to have the last word. We want to be right, even if we are wrong. But still, we want to prove that we are actually right. And this is all the defense mechanism around the ego, that we are defending and protecting the false ego. So instead of giving up the false ego, we do the opposite. We defend, we protect. And interestingly, here we have the first rule of Vaishnav etiquette. As we were mentioning yesterday, Vaishnav etiquette and culture is our saving grace. So Vaishnava etiquette and culture tells us that a Vaishnava should never defend him or herself. Yes. We should defend other Vaishnavas, but we should never defend ourselves. I don't even think we are aware of this. Isn't it? There's never any talk about it. Because it's so subtle. You know? And we do it all the time. Actually, some time ago, I was giving exactly the seminar. And afterwards, I was talking to one Prabhu. And there was some issue. And I was saying something. And immediately he defended. And I was smiling and saying, Prabhu, we just talked about it. We shouldn't defend. He couldn't even hear it. Yes, but blah, 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 you know? And what could I say? I was just smiling to myself, thinking, my God, this is how strong this propensity is to defend. Even after that session, immediately he was falling back into this patterns of defense. You know? So, this is a very interesting point, and of course, now we don't have the full time to discuss this in whole. We are just introducing it now, and I'm very much hoping that you will all come back at 5 o'clock in the classroom up there somewhere, and we will complete this whole discussion on the defense. Because one question usually comes up saying, well, but, you know, aren't there situations in life where we have to defend, and where will we get when we just don't defend? Right? This is usually on people's minds. So first of all, yes, Krishna permits defense when one of the six aggressors is attacking. What are the six aggressors? Anybody remembers? Huh? Stealing wife? Put fire, set fire to the house? What else? Stealing one's wealth? And what else? Stealing one more thing? Hang on, I have to look at the list here myself. Stealing the land, occupying one's land, you know, so it's three times stealing. The wife, the wealth, the land. And then what else? Setting fire, we said. Two more. Giving poison, exactly. And one more. No? Yeah, attacking with a deadly weapon. These are the six aggressors. So, if you're attacked by one of these six aggressors, then you're allowed to defend. But let's be honest, this doesn't happen every day. You know? Right? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's a very exceptional emergency situation. If one of these six aggressors attacking. So that's when we are allowed to defend. But we are defending every day verbally, you know, without these six aggressors attacking.
What if somebody looks at your wife and steals your bicycle?
What if somebody looks at your wife and steals your bicycle? Anyway, Let's not get into the details here. And what about this situation? And what about that situation? Let's just keep it at the six aggressors. If you consider your bicycle your wealth, all right, you know, if you're right there when he takes your bicycle, of course, then you run after him and get the bicycle back. Fair enough, you know, but let's not waste time in working out all kinds of details here. There's unlimited variations. But anyway, So that's the point. This tendency of answering back, wanting to have the last word, wanting to prove that we are right. You know, this is so strong. It's the ego pushing us, you know, to get that satisfaction. And the etiquette rule is also that, especially towards seniors, this is so, it's a no-no. You know, answering back towards a senior, it's a no-no. For the wife, answering back to the husband is a no-no, according to Vaishnav culture and etiquette, actually. Yes. There's a few purports in the Bhagavatam where Prabhupada says that a husband always wants to be considered superior. And even if there's some wrongdoings on the part of the husband, the wife has to tolerate. Sorry, this is completely against the modern ideas. Well, 269 in Bhagavad Gita, what is day to the materialist is night to the introspective sage. So the two worldviews, the two understandings, materialistic, spiritual, is completely opposite. Yeah. So in any case, answering back towards a senior is considered to be so gross and uncultured. Yes, completely. Especially towards guru. Oh my God. Yes. I mean, Prabhupada used to get furious if devotees were falling into this, you know, when Prabhupada was saying something and then the devotees say, yes, but Prabhupada, but, you know, whenever the sentence starts with this but, you know, it means we are defending, you know, and Prabhupada used to get furious. Because it's such a bad way to act towards guru. Even if guru doesn't know the details, even if guru is wrong, so-called wrong, still as a devotee, we accept, we say, alright, there must be some reason why Krishna puts me into this situation, you know, so alright, maybe here I am right, but so many other situations, I was wrong. So let me just tolerate. Let me take this as an opportunity to tolerate. Even if I'm unfairly accused of something. That's the Vaishnav mood, actually. And if everybody follows the Vaishnav etiquette of not defending himself, him or herself, when I say him, I usually mean both genders, you know, just instead of saying him, her, self, I just say himself, but I'm related to both genders. So if every Vaishnava follows this, not defending himself, but defending other devotees, then surely, even if we are accused in the wrong way, there should be some other devotee who will point this out and who will defend us, right? If everybody follows the etiquette, we don't need to defend ourselves. Somebody else will do it. Isn't it? Yes, yeah. But what do? We don't defend others. You know, we don't want to stick out our head and step forward and defend others. And we defend ourselves. We do exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. Isn't it? You know, so often we see it, that if somebody is unfairly treated, unjustly, we just turn our head, we don't see it, oh, well, it's none of my business, you know. Yes, instead of, you know, defending that person. And everybody is just defending themselves. That's the modern way of doing things. But it's completely against Vaishnava etiquette, completely, you know, yes. Yes. So, I mean, these things are almost unknown, unheard in the Western world, you know. Yeah, I've learned all these things in Bangladesh, you know. There are people to follow these things. And there to answer back to somebody who is senior is considered to be so, so uncultured and wrong, you know. Yes, yes, yes. So this is just Krishna's way of assisting us, you know, to let go of things, to let go of this ego satisfaction and protection and defense and, you know. Yes. Yeah. Oh my God, it's so strong, this tendency to defend. We don't even realize, because we are not conscious of it and we are not sensitized towards it. But now after this discussion, I'm hoping that this will help you to be a little introspective. And you will catch yourselves, oh, here we go. And, you know, yes, yes, we have to become sensitized and aware of these things. Otherwise, as we were saying yesterday, we chant the holy name and then immediately we throw the dust back on our back. And, you know, we fall back into our ego patterns of behaviors. And then we don't get anywhere. We don't get anywhere. You know, because we commit the tenth offense of chanting the holy name to maintain material attachments even after understanding so many instructions on this matter. So we maintain this ego satisfaction of trying to be right and knowing better and. You know? Yes. So this is quite a challenge for many devotees, you know, to hear that even if I'm wrongly accused, unfairly treated, actually, the Vaishnav mood is to not to defend and simply rely on this that somebody else defends us. Relying on this, then Krishna will reveal. And of course, if we are asked, oh, Prabhu, can you tell me how was it really all right? Then humbly we tell how the situation was or something, you know. But we should not... oh, get all agitated and defend and, oh no, it wasn't like that, it wasn't me and, you know, no. And interestingly, as we mentioned yesterday already, false ego is really affecting the intelligence immensely. And the intelligence can twist things around in such a way just to justify that I am right and everybody else is wrong. Have you ever come across that? Yes. I mean, this is an interesting thing to understand, that there is no objective experience. Even hearing experience, everybody sitting here hears something different according to our own consciousness, our own mindset, our own attachments. We hear differently. There is no the objective experience. And I have come across situations where I'm thinking, how is it possible? How is it possible that a person experiences a situation so distorted, so differently than it actually was? Right? Have you ever come across that? Yes, some people are nodding. Yes, you know, that in some conflict situation and then there's some discussion how what actually happened, you hear so many different versions. Right? Yes, yes. And sometimes, you know, if the ego is very strong and wants to be right, then the ego affects the intelligence. And the intelligence twists things around and fabricates things, you know, just so I'm right and everybody else is wrong. And you may be thinking, my God, how is it possible? Is this person actually just bluntly lying or making things up? Or what's actually going on here? How is it possible? The person might be lying, we don't know. But a good chance is there that it's the false ego affecting so much the intelligence, and the person actually believes his version of the truth. He believes it. You know? Yes, yes, yes. Very often he believes. Sometimes he might be sneaky and just making things up. I don't know. Can also be. But very often the person firmly believes this is what happened. And why? Because the false ego is affecting the intelligence so much and covering and contaminating the intelligence. Yeah? And then the intelligence comes up with that reasoning. Yes. Yes. This is how the false ego affects the intelligence immensely. You know? Yes. Yes. It's just interesting to understand, isn't it? I mean, I find it very, very interesting to understand how it all works, you know? So, and again, unless we have a mentor, unless we have this trusting, confidential relationship with a senior devotee, where we know we can open our heart, we can share our innermost fears and battles, you know, and that person has no other intention than helping us in our spiritual journey. No managerial interests, no emotional interests, no financial interests. We discussed it last year in the seminar, and it's in the book. You know, but simply the only interest, my spiritual growth and development. That such a person is immensely important in our spiritual development. Otherwise, what happens? We take shelter of the false ego. That's what happens. You know, and it happens so many times that we get offended, we walk out, we leave Krishna consciousness because we take shelter of our ego. Oh, I'm right. How can they treat me like this? And. You know, yes. Without such a sheltering relationship, no chance to survive. We've lost so many devotees over the last, you know, 50 years because we have not recognized the importance of these sheltering relationships. Our Diksha Gurus are usually too far away and they don't have time to get involved with each and every one of its thousands of disciples to work out what was the situation and. We need somebody on the more local level, you know. Okay, few minutes past 9. Let me see, is there some concluding question to this session? Yes? Depending on how much overtime you allow me here.
It's again from Facebook.
Okay.
Okay, he wrote, they preach from perspective of brahmachari, vanaprastha and sannyasis, which they have no bills to pay, etc. But the most people, 95%, are grihasthas, kshatriya, vaishya and shudra, and if they are without goals, like she said, will be hungry, depressed, etc. Without goals even in spiritual life, you don't know where you are going, so how can progress then?
Well, as I was explaining, you know, the Vaishnava way to success is developing a burning desire to serve. And we might have some ideas how we can serve. So we get the sanction, we ask for guidance, blessings. But what we usually do is we make our decisions and we ask, you know, just the blessings we are asking is just lip service. It's just formality. I've made already my decision, so you give me the blessings for my decision. No, the real blessings is we ask for guidance, advice, mentorship. Here we go again. You know, our mentor can see, you know, how we can actually contribute. You know, so we might have some goals, some ideas, but we have to get the guidance, you know. And as I was explaining, if we cultivate this burning desire to serve, everything else from there will open up. Guaranteed. I experienced it in my own life. I had never ever any big plans of doing this or that or whatever, you know. All I wanted to do is serve. And then when my husband walked out, I said to Nandaswami in a darshan, I said to him, oh, I'm thinking I would like to preach a little bit. And he was jumping off his seat and said, do you want to preach? Come to Ukraine. Come to Ukraine. You know, he immediately invited me. Come to Ukraine. Preach. You know, so this is how we are meant to go about it. You know, that we, all right, we might have some idea and we reveal our mind to a trusting person. And then we see what he says. You know? rather than we having our big ambitions. So if people are just sitting and their life is not going anywhere, it usually means they're not cultivating an intense burning desire to serve. That's all it means. You know? Yes. Prabhu.
When we are introspective and we notice the act of false ego, because of enjoyment of fear or something, and I notice by myself that actually I'm addicted.
Mm. Yes.
And my question is, how much is it this distance of selection? How much is it dependent the change of this, of our endeavor, and how much from the mercy of God?
Good question. Let's park it for the afternoon. There I'm planning to give these 6 steps. How to go about it. You back this afternoon, 5:00? You have to hear the answer. Or you have to listen to the recordings later. Or you have to wait until I put it into book form next year. Okay, thank you so much. We'll continue at 5:00 in the classroom upstairs. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveda Bhaktavinda ki, Gaurav Premanandi, Hare Krishna.